Hello, it's John Dennis on Tuesday the 10th of March. Today, Britain is condemned by the United Nations for its involvement in America's rendition programme.
The government is under increasing pressure and they can't just say, you know, no case to answer.
Also today, Northern Ireland's political leaders unite against the dissident Real IRA terrorists.
There is a spirit in Northern Ireland, not characterised by the evil that we saw on Saturday, but of the good that we saw on Sunday and since, where people in Northern Ireland together are saying loudly and clearly, we are not going back.
And the authors of a new book called The Spirit Level explain why we should reduce inequality.
The more equal countries have better health, they have fewer teenage pregnancies, they have less violence, kids do better at school, they have lower obesity rates, fewer people in prison, a great host of problems where more equal societies seem to do much better.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, let's hear what's in the news headlines and have a look at the papers.
In an escalation of tension in Northern Ireland, a policeman was killed last night. He's the first officer to be murdered in 10 years. He was killed on a Catholic housing estate in Craigavon. Local reports say that he was shot at long range. His death comes 2 days after the killing of two soldiers outside their barracks in Antrim. The chief constable said he'd been shot with his colleagues, responding to a call for help from a vulnerable person. The Real IRA claimed responsibility for the deaths of the two soldiers. Nationalist politicians, as well as unionists, have condemned the latest murder. Britain's been condemned by the United Nations for involvement in illegal acts in the fight against terrorism. A UN report says that Britain was involved in helping the USA move terrorist suspects around foreign jails. It adds that Britain, as well as other countries, sent interrogators to Guantanamo Bay, which implied that they condoned torture and ill treatment. The report also accuses British intelligence officers of interviewing detainees in Pakistan, where they are being tortured. We'll have the full story shortly. In Sri Lanka, a bomb detonated by a suspected suicide bomber at a mosque has killed at least 10 people. Three government ministers were also injured as they attended an Islamic celebration at the mosque in the south of the country. The government is currently laying siege to the Tamil Tigers' rebel stronghold in the north. On the 50th anniversary of his exile from Tibet, the Dalai Lama is demanding meaningful autonomy for his homeland. 10,000 Tibetans have travelled from around the world to see him in Dharamsala in northern India. He'll tell them that from time immemorial, the Tibetan and Chinese people have been neighbours. He mourns the suffering and destruction wrought by Chinese communist campaigns. In the US, Ford car workers have agreed to accept big changes in their wages and conditions of service to keep the company competitive. It'll mean that wages will be frozen and there'll be no cost of living pay increases. Ford is the only big US car company not to have asked the government for a loan. The murder of the Northern Ireland policeman happened too late to be reported in the morning papers, so many of them lead with the death of the two soldiers. Several carry pictures of Sapper Mark Quincy with his mother and sister, and another of Sapper Patrick Azimka. Our brave boys, the Mirror calls them. The Mail says that Mark was a dedicated soldier, ready to risk his life for the Afghan people. IRA executioners ensured he never got the chance. But the Times reports that the security at the barracks was put under review a year ago and that shortcomings were again being examined. One guard, one pistol, three killers, 60 rounds, reads the paper's headline. And the Telegraph attacks Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams for playing politics with the murder of the two soldiers. Adams fans the flames, reads their headline, over a story reporting him saying that the army was not wanted in Northern Ireland. The Guardian leads with a story of the UN criticism of Britain over the human rights of terrorist suspects. It also features a report about the former Children's Services chief sacked by Haringey after the Baby P case. She's going to challenge the Minister Ed Balls for the part he played in her dismissal. And The Independent claims that we're now a nation divided by recession. It says that young affluent households are prospering at the expense of pensioners. More news throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The UK has been condemned for its involvement in the United States system of rendition, now outlawed by Barack Obama. In a highly critical report, the UN's special rapporteur, Michael Shinin, said America couldn't have moved terror suspects around foreign jails without the support of allies such as Britain. With the details is our security editor, Richard Norton Taylor.
It singles out Britain, it mentions other countries as well, who Britain probably won't want to be associated with when it comes to torture, in being a significant country in colluding with the CIA's policy of rendering, that is secretly transferring prisoners to dark prisons, or detainees to dark prisons, where they were tortured, we now know, and how it basically comes at a time when there's been a lot of allegations about MI5's collusion with the American practice and with the torture of British residents around the world in dark prisons. But this actually says that it provides more evidence, and it comes, it's a UN report, so it's got much more authority, really, than one or two allegations by lawyers here and there for defendants. And it says that without British help, really, and the help of other countries too, the Americans wouldn't have been able to carry out their policy of extraordinary rendition, you know, sending prisoners to places where they were tortured so easily.
What does it say about the way governments, including in Britain, concealed their involvement in the system of extraordinary rendition?
It uses very, very strong language. This UN report by a special rapporteur, as they call them, basically it accuses the British government of colluding in torture because it allowed its security intelligence agency to do so. And that is against international law. It also says that Britain, amongst other countries, concealed illegal acts from oversight bodies like, say, Parliament or MPs, or judicial authorities, i.e. the courts, or to protect itself from criticism, embarrassment, and most importantly, liability. I mean, if international law meant anything at all, I suppose you could argue that Britain should be held up before an international criminal court. It won't get that far. But it comes against a background where the British High Court has said, especially in a case which The Guardian has been writing about for a long time, a former UK resident in Guantanamo Bay called Binyam Mohammed, where the British High Court have made it quite clear they want disclosure of evidence which the British government has, David Miliband, the Foreign Secretary, has, mainly from US documents, of collusion in the torture and the torture of this UK resident. And the High Court, the judges in the High Court want this to be released, but can't because the government says to do so will threaten our relations with America.
I mean, what exactly Britain's role was in all this is still unclear. I mean, this does increase the pressure on ministers for an independent inquiry into Britain's role.
It does, I think. I mean, I don't know how much more will come out when. I think something's going to come out. It's going to be maybe the drip-drip effect. And that's what's happened in other cases where the British government has been sort of tried to sort of put its head in the sand or put a finger in the dike or whatever cliche one wants to use, and things have come out, especially in America, which information, it's going to come out in America. So I think, and also the Attorney General is looking into allegations actually put to her, Lady of Scotland, by Jackie Smith, the Home Secretary, because of various court cases. So the government is under increasing pressure, as you say, and it can't just say, you know, no case to answer, I'm afraid. It can't just stay there. I think it'd have to go to some kind of independent inquiry, but it'll probably be, or try, it'll try and set up one which is a Privy Council inquiry, say a secret behind the closed doors inquiry. We'll try for something more open, of course.
Richard Norton Taylor, and there's full coverage today at guardian.co.uk/UK. Also on The Guardian's website today, the Myerson saga continues. Jonathan Myerson adds his thoughts at guardian.co.uk/G2. Joan Smith argues that the government's latest initiative on domestic violence is nothing but a headline-grabbing gimmick. Have your say at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. And magician Paul Daniels on the late Ali Bongo's greatest trick at guardian.co.uk/arts. The two soldiers murdered by real IRA terrorists at Massarine Barracks in Antrim have been named as Sapper Mark Quincy, who was 23 and from Birmingham, and Sapper Cengiz Azimkar, who was 21 and from Wood Green in North London. During a visit to Massarine, Gordon Brown insisted that the attacks, in which two civilians delivering pizzas were seriously injured, had not shaken the Northern Ireland political process. Henry MacDonald is our Ireland correspondent.
Well, I think it's important to say at the start here that the strategy behind this attack, apart from killing British military personnel, was indeed to create a political crisis which would ultimately end in the collapse of the power-sharing executive, that, you know, it would create a divergent attitude in terms of security policy to the response, i.e. the DUP would want a hardline crackdown, Sinn Féin would oppose that, and that would make them sharing power together impossible in the long run. But it hasn't happened because, I think, Sinn Féin leaders have been fairly forthright over the last 24 hours in condemning the real IRA attack. Indeed, one Sinn Féin assembly member even said, we have to rethink our taboos about, you know, people passing on information to the PSNI. That was in the past, that would have been regarded as treachery. So also Peter Robinson made a very effusive speech in which he promised that he wouldn't want to bring down the institutions because of the acts of the real IRA. So far in this one act and its fallout, I think the institutions are still intact.
And you did note in Monday's Guardian, Henry, that the fact that Gerry Adams and Martin McGuinness and Sinn Féin have backed the police and denounced the attackers, a historic moment for Northern Ireland.
Well, it's one of these turning points that we seem to need to get over or to get round, and this is yet another one. Sinn Féin signing up to policing was a massive ideological shift in mainstream republicanism. We now have another one, which is that they're actually calling for people to cooperate in the hunt for those killers. That would have been unthinkable many, many years ago during the Troubles. So it is another turning point, yes, and it is significant.
Gordon Brown dismissed the real IRA as a small, self-obsessed group of thugs with no political support in Northern Ireland. If that's true, will that mean that the men who carried out this attack are likely to be tracked down?
Well, they may be likely to be tracked down, but it's convicting them is the problem. Whatever political support they have, or lack of political support they have, long-standing experience in counter-interrogation techniques and avoiding contamination with forensics, for instance. And it's interesting that Michael Gallagher, who's a big campaigner for the Uma bomb victims, his son indeed was killed in that atrocity, has predicted that the killers will not be brought to justice, that such is the nature of the legal system and also the ability of terrorists to clean up really what they've done and not implicate themselves. It will mean that they won't, that those killers won't be brought to justice. That's quite a strong prediction.
And how much popular support is there for this action? Is there any popular support?
Well, there's not. I think the overwhelming majority of, let's say, people from the nationalist community would be opposed to it, as much as it's overwhelmingly condemned by the unionist community. There may be a small slither of support within the Republican base. There is undoubtedly some support, but it isn't significant. You're not talking even into double percentage figures here. But, you know, 10 men determined can keep a campaign going, and that's the key. The key is, what will they do next? Can they sustain this campaign? And the longer they sustain it, the more damaging it is in terms of human life and sabotage. That puts further pressure on the security forces, which in turn puts pressure on the political process, because, you know, can Sinn Féin be seen to be supporting a security crackdown? They will be accused by their rivals on the fringes of republicanism of joining the state against us traditional republicans. So a lot of dilemmas posed if the real IRA are able to, you know, do more and keep this campaign going. If this is a one-off, it won't destabilize the power-sharing executive.
A conference this week in New York entitled Global Warming, Was It Ever Really a Crisis? Features some of the most prominent naysayers in the climate change debate. It aims to confront the scientific establishment, the vast majority of whose members argue that humans are the principal cause of climate change. The guests at what's being billed as the largest ever gathering of climate change deniers include a retired astronaut, the current European president, and physicist Richard Lindzen from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. He gave one of the keynote speeches at the conference, and he told The Guardian's Suzanne Goldenberg how it felt being on the wrong side of the consensus. world's largest democracy. The general election takes place from the 16th of April to the 13th of May. India presents itself as a thrusting young Asian superpower, but our foreign affairs columnist Simon Tisdall says the election highlights the shortcomings of India's political processes.
Well, India, rightly in some ways, has put itself forward as a very up-and-coming, go-ahead Asian superpower for the 21st century, but its political system really hasn't evolved very much in the last few decades. You've still got basically a choice between two main parties, the Congress Party, which is currently in power, which was founded by the Gandhis and Nehru, and right back to independence, and the BJP, the Hindu Nationalist Party, which was in power until 2004. And the leaders of these parties are both veterans of the political scene. They've both been around for a long time. Manmohan Singh, the current Prime Minister, 76, just recovering from heart surgery. And the leader of the BJP is L.K. Advani, who's even older, 81. And this is hardly the image that maybe India wants to present to itself in the It's a go-ahead power.
And we're looking at no clear outcome after these weeks of voting. And so, you know, it could lead to months of wrangling between the two main parties and leaving regional powers wielding, a disproportionate amount of power.
Well, India's got used to the idea of coalition governments over the last few years, and all the political analysts say that this one will be no different. That the election will result in either giving a balance of power to what's called a third front of smaller parties, or it will give a much greater power to regional parties based in certain big states like Uttar Pradesh, who will effectively become power brokers. That could lead to months of negotiations before a new coalition government is formed. It also means that a lot of the promises these politicians are making to the electorate right now will be compromised in the deal making ahead.
And what about the issue of security? Because it's not just Pakistan, is it, that that neighbours in India with severe and worsening security problems?
Yeah, this election takes place in the context of a deteriorating security situation all around India's borders, really. It's not just the very well-known problems in Pakistan where there's growing instability and speculation of a military coup and so on. It's not just the US-NATO campaign in Afghanistan, which is not going well and is spilling over into other parts of that region. It's the denouement to the very murderous civil war in Sri Lanka. It's an army mutiny in Bangladesh recently. It's unrest in Kashmir, and it's political turmoil in Nepal. So all these factors combined to make this a rather an unstable time to be trying to, for the world's biggest democracy, to be trying to conduct a democratic process.
And India's being hit, like everyone else, by the recession. Do the main parties have clear and, you know, very differing remedies for easing India during this difficult economic time?
Well, not really, John. According to the people who know better than me, the people on the ground and economic analysts and so on say that the BJP, which is in theory in favour of more free market agenda and economic reform, actually never really manages to deliver that agenda. And the Congress Party, which is more in favour of sort of social relief and empowerment policies, has mismanaged those policies, which have been affected by corruption. So you get a kind of mishmash of things, and some analysts say there's no real clear distinction between the two party platforms.
Simon Tisdall. More unequal societies, those with a bigger gap between the wealthy and the poor, are more likely to suffer from a range of problems. Low pay and low self-esteem, poor health and poor life expectancy. And these aren't just a problem for those at the bottom of rich societies such as the UK. They affect people at all levels, including those at the top. That's what the academic epidemiologists Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett argue in their new book, The Spirit Level. So, why do more equal societies almost always do better?
Well, we think the central idea is to do with relative social position, the social differences between us, and status competition. So that in a more unequal society, the distances between us, the social distances, are sort of stretched out. And it's those differences and the way they make us feel and the way our feelings make us behave or act directly on our bodies that mean that we see a whole host of health and social problems being more prevalent, being much more problematic in more unequal societies.
I think I should clarify what we mean by saying that more equal societies almost always do better. We've looked at all sorts of social problems and health issues and find that societies with smaller income differences between rich and poor That means societies like Japan or the Scandinavian countries compared to Britain or Portugal or United States, which all have much bigger income gaps. The more equal countries have better health. They have fewer teenage pregnancies. They have less violence. Kids do better at school. They have lower obesity rates, fewer people in prison, a great host of problems where more equal societies seem to do much better.
Kate, the richest in Sweden score better in literacy tests than the richest in the more unequal societies such as Britain. Why should that be the case?
Yes, well, we do see that the effects of inequality seem to go all the way up society. And although people at the bottom seem to benefit the most in a more unequal society, you're right, even at near the very top, people seem to be doing better. And we think probably there are two reasons for that. One is that we're seeing long-term effects of early childhood damages from inequality showing up in adolescents, in teenagers who are taking these tests. So that family life is more stressed, more strained in more unequal societies. And that's applying to everybody, not just the poor. And we're seeing that reflected in how children do, how they grow up. But also, we think there are very direct effects of inequality on things like cognitive performance. And so even if you're close to the top, but you're not at the very top, there is still a sense of your relative social position being lower than somebody else's. And that clearly can affect performance across a whole range of things.
But there are all sorts of experiments with kids, for instance, in primary schools where you artificially make a distinction, say the kids with blue eyes or brown eyes are better than the others, and you see how it affects their performance, and then you say, oh, I got it wrong, and it's the kids with the other colour eyes who do better, and over the next week you realise how it affects their performance. There are lots of experiments showing how affected we are by these social stereotypes that seem to have implications for people's expectations of our ability. So ability really conforms to those expectations.
If we accept that equality in a more equal society is a desirable thing, how should policymakers go about reducing inequality?
Well, we're epidemiologists, you know, we're not policymakers. And I think the most important thing we have to say on that is that it's clear that there are different ways to achieve equality. Different societies become more equal in different ways. Some do it through government solutions such as redistribution, welfare benefits and taxes, and others achieve greater equality by having smaller differences in earnings in the first place. So I think what we would say is that it doesn't matter how you get there, it just matters that you get there somehow.
Yes, they're very striking examples. I mean, Sweden is the big state example, depends on redistribution of income to get its greater equality. Japan, quite the opposite. It does much less redistribution, smaller differences in earnings before redistribution, and of course much less welfare expenditure. And we see the same contrasts amongst the American states, where we've also looked to see whether greater equality produces these benefits.
Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett. And The Spirit Level, Why More Equal Societies Almost Always Do Better, is published by Alan Lane. And you can listen to a longer version of that interview at guardian.co.uk/books. Phil Maynard and Tim Mabey produced today's edition of Guardian Daily. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.